Good morning, everyone. Is everyone awake and ready? What was that? Okay. Will you please pray with me?
O Heavenly Father.
Divine Mother.
Beloved Jesus Christ.
Blessed Master.
Saints and sages of all religions.
I bow to all of you. Free my life from all obstacles. And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development. Make my mind thy temple.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my love thy home.
Be thou the only king.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness. Wonderful Christmas season and New Year season, and it's been a busy time, but a very fulfilling time. It seems to me there's been something special, particularly about the New Year's service, that was so powerful and so pure and so lovely. And it makes me think that perhaps this coming year is going to be a very special year as well. So one of the things that I want to let you know is that Larry on the website has put up a very special rendition. Thus Speak Ram Dass is a small booklet that's been put out by the ashram for a long time. Swami Satchidananda at one point time was recorded as reading through Thus Speak Ram Dass. And so up on the website we put the entirety of his speaking that is split up both by chapter, you can listen chapter by chapter, or the entirety of it. And also the text is up there, and you can print it out. I printed this out, and it turns into a lovely little booklet. You can print out, staple, fold it together if you like, if you don't have a copy. Or you can read it on your computer screen in case there's anything that's difficult to understand. So I think that's a wonderful gift. One other thing is I think the last two Sundays here there will not be service here. You'll be gone.
It's not the last two Sundays, it's the next two Sundays.
Next two Sundays, thank you. So the next two Sundays there'll be no service here. There will be service in Mount Vernon. So we'll have Mother's Maha Samadhi. That'll be the last Sunday. And we'll have service here traditionally on Mother's Maha Samadhi. We go out to the cemetery site. And then afterwards, in honor of Mother only, that's the only reason we do it, we go out for hot fudge Sundays because that was Mother's favorite, one of her favorites. So we do it as some tapasya, some surrender to the whole thing, but we might even enjoy it a little bit. So that'll happen after service. We'll have lunch, and then we'll go out to the cemetery, and then we'll have lunch and hot fudge sundaes, and then we'll go out to the cemetery. So we'll do it in a little bit different order because it does fall on a Sunday this year. Thank you. Interesting survey that was taken around the world asking people the question, do you believe in heaven? Paradise, here we come. A majority of people in all but one of 16 countries surveyed agreed on our final destination. Does such a unified belief in an afterlife mean we are all devout? Seems not. In another survey, many of the same countries shared very different opinions on how important religion is to them. In India, 92% said it is very important. In Russia, Only 14% said so. Here's Ludmila Moslava, who's 34 years old, from Moscow, Russia. I quote, "I started to believe in heaven only as I got older and further from my Soviet upbringing. Now, my belief helps me through tough times." And this is Frederick Antonat, 30 years old, from France. "Heaven? No, but I think we keep existing in following generations." It's an interesting comment. And a 30-year-old, Andre, I don't know how to pronounce this, Segura. "I'm Catholic, and I do believe that life is eternal." And Zhao Wang, 20 years old, from China, a very honest answer. "Objectively, I don't believe in heaven, but I still like to feel there is one." So that's very interesting, I think. Oh, and one other announcement is Master's birthday is this coming Tuesday. I'd like to read from our Cross and Lotus Journal an article by Peter Schultz, "Being in Business with God." "I've had this thing about being a businessman since as long as I can remember, since I was a little kid, actually. I've always wanted to be a good one, you know, making wise decisions, building a huge financial empire as all those around you gather at your feet to bask in your wisdom. Great fantasy. The only problem is it hasn't worked out that way. The truth is I'm a bit of an idiot. The only reason I have a business that supports my family at all is because I kept at it long enough to overcome a mind-boggling series of amazingly stupid mistakes. So right now I'm going to give you a million-dollar piece of advice you can use in your own business or your business of life. Ready? Here it is. Every one of those mistakes was made about as far from a God-conscious state as you can get. Every one of those mistakes was made about as far from a God-conscious state as you can get. Here's the opposite side of that statement. Putting your mind on God means profit. Putting your mind on God means more money, more love, more freedom, more great ideas, more well-being, more laughter, a better life, not someday, but right now. Yeah, there's a recession on right now. So what? The only real recession that exists is a recession in God consciousness. Isn't that a wonderful statement? The only real recession that exists is a recession in God consciousness. That's absolutely true. The revenue for my business is down 25% last year. After a good deal of fretting and hand-wringing, I finally found a solution. I sit at my little computer in my little office and put my mind on God. And you might be pretty amazed at what God comes up with. Talk about a good businessman. God has ideas, good ideas. God has enough life force for you to get them done. God has a customer list that can swamp your business with fresh new orders. God will send you emails telling you how great your product or service is, swelling you up with the incentive to do even better. If you want an awesome business partner, God is the one. God will make you a fortune, and most importantly, He'll make you fortunate. Walk with God, and you will become rich in every good sense of the word. Here's another trick. Scared about money? Hard time paying your bills? Don't know what you're going to do? Spending a few nights tossing and turning, wondering how you're going to how you got yourself into this mess? Here's the trick. Put your mind on God. You cannot put your mind on God and be scared at the same time. It's impossible. I've tried. Have you ever seen one of those movies where the hero is really down on his luck? Boy, his business failed. He lost all of his tools, his shop burned down, and the poor fellow is homeless, walking down the road with nothing. And then it starts to rain. And you're sitting there in the audience, really rooting for him. You want to shout, "Don't give up, you still have a chance, keep going, you can make it!" Well, that's the way it is when you're down on your luck and you suddenly strike up a conversation with God. It's not happening to you anymore. You stepped outside of the situation and you're watching the movie with God and you are shouting, "Don't give up. You still have a chance. There are lots of things you can do." And God is right there with you, giving you that feeling of hope and goodness and richness and ideas in the ideal world, which with His life force manifest themselves here in the material. Truth is, you cannot do without God. Oh, sure, there are a few that are so trained in past lives and this one that they can make a fortune in money or build a big business without putting their mind on God. But they'll never be rich, not like the God man. I've been focused on my money my whole life, and the richest people I've met are Mother Hamilton, Swami Satchitananda, and David Hickenbottom. They make the Rockefellers look like beggars. So if you want to have a great business and be rich, really rich, go to God. There is no other path except by me, saith the Lord. And He wasn't kidding. This comes from Self-Realization magazine, January-February 1952, from Mother's Library, Spiritual Interpretation of the Bhagavad Gita, Chapter 5, Stanza 11. The translation in the literal, "For sanctification of the ego, yogis perform all actions without attachment, whether they work with the body, mind, or discrimination, or merely with the organs of sense," the spiritual interpretation. The proper art of action leads to purification of the ego. Yogis should not perform any action instigated by egotism or likes or dislikes of the heart. They should perform dutiful actions as inspired by God and the guru preceptor, using body, senses, mind, and intellect in a non-attached way. Working without attachment does not mean that one should work mechanically. The truly spiritual man works not egotistically, but ambitiously, because he is anxious to please his beloved. One who cannot distinguish between divine inspiration and selfish desires should ask the guidance of his guru. When a devotee discovers his life duties, he should perform them with intense interest to please God and the Guru, without being attached to the fruits of action. A true lover of the Lord is happy to succeed in any of His divine adventures, but when he is thwarted or opposed, he does not weep and lose enthusiasm. He tries with deeper interest and stronger effort to achieve what he has previously failed to accomplish for God, unless his guru directs him to do otherwise. For the advanced student, a few hints are given in the following lines about the sanctification of the self. Many mere passages are clogged up in the ordinary man's body, owing to bodily toxins. Also, the nerves engaging in enjoying sense objects become matter bent. The flow of life force is from the brain to the senses, a descent that attracts the consciousness to material objects. These outward bent nerves and their gross state of sense entanglement are detrimental to soul perception. Yogis therefore advise proper diet, postures, and Kriya Yoga to purify the nerves so that they become spirit bent, leading the consciousness away from the senses. By asanas, mudras, control of life force, chanting, prayers, penetrating the mind, and life energy through the seven spinal centers, concentration on the infinite and deep devotion, one can purify the body, mind, and heart to serve as receptacles of the infinite. I would like to speak this morning on a topic that was entitled by Mother. She said, when you're in business with God, you're in business with all of life. And this is absolutely true. There's no aspect of your life that you can say is divided from God. As we know, when we seek out the universal vision, it is a vision that God is within everything that there is in all creation. And when you think about it, if you define God as the creator of all creation, how can there be any aspect of creation that is separated from God? It would be literally impossible. As I have said many times, that this world is made up of God stuff. You are made up of God stuff. Everything that you see, everything that you perceive, everything that you know is made up of God stuff. Now, from a human standpoint, this sounds confusing. Because we look out on this world, we look within ourselves, we see our own impulses, our own desires, we see the activities and actions of others, and we don't see reflected in those actions, those activities, those thoughts, the God-like nature that we worship. And this is because we are existing in a realm of duality. Duality means opposites, that there is good and that there is bad. There is high and there is low. There are things that please us and things that displease us. And this is natural to every human being who enters into a body consciousness. By definition, being in body consciousness means that we are entering into this level of duality. So when we speak of the universal vision, by definition, it has to surpass duality. It has to go beyond it in some way. Now, if we are trained only to see things through a dualistic nature, this will sound completely baffling. But when we enter, really enter, into the spiritual path, it takes us into a new state of consciousness. It is as if we are born new again. As Jesus said, what is born of water is water. What is born of spirit is spirit. What is born of this body is the body. What is born of God is God. When you are born of this body, you enter into this dualism. When you are born into God, you rise higher than this dualism. And when you do, you then see that all the activity, all the creation, everything that is made up of this God stuff. You see it for real. It's not an idea that you accept. It's not part of an imaginary scenario that you make up for yourself. It becomes a living reality. And it is so profound, it is so deep, it is so moving, that you realize it is a greater reality, a more powerful reality, a truer reality than anything you've experienced thus far. And when this happens, the world of duality seems like a dream. Now, as you intensify your aspiration for God, you are lifted up into this state. And at that point, the world seems more and more dreamlike. It seems like it is just a play. And it is something that is on the periphery of your consciousness, but what is front and center for you is the presence of God, is the feeling of the God-like nature. And when you open these eyes, as you have purified the mind, you look out through these two eyes and you see nothing but God everywhere. Therefore, when you are in business with God, you are in business with all of life, because all of life is from God and exists within God. And now your consciousness is completely and totally transformed. We watched a movie last night called Flywheel. It's a very low-budget movie. They made it for $20,000. It's made by a church, I believe down near Georgia, that they decided, they thought, reasoned with themselves that movies and music have such a profound influence on people. And on any day, there are many more people going to the theater than there are going to church. So they thought, let's make a movie that perhaps people will be interested in. And for a $20,000 movie, it's a very good movie. And it's about a used car salesman. Now, we know what the reputations of used car salesmen are. And he was every bit of that and more. He would lie, he would cheat, he would steal. He would do whatever he could. It was an amusing kind of scenario that they had sitting in church. His wife would kind of drag him to church, and he would go there, and they would pass around the collection plate. And everybody had envelopes that they would stuff their money or checks or whatever into for their donation. And he'd be sitting there, and he sat there with his envelope, and at one point he opened up the envelope, and then you looked inside, and there's nothing in it. But when the bull came along, he dutifully put his empty envelope right in there with everybody else, making a good show, but there's nothing there. It's empty. His spiritual life was empty. And eventually his life became unglued, came apart, and he realized that it was beyond his control to put it back together. His relationships, his business, everything was going downhill, and the movie was about how he changed his life. He turned his business and his life over to God, and how the revolution happened. And he had to face some pretty tough stuff because he had done things that went against the law of God, went against the law of good business, went against the law of good relationships, and he had to pay a price there. But he was willing to do it, and he stuck with it, and miraculous things began to happen as a result. And it's a wonderful little movie if you get a chance to see it. It's called Flywheel. We have our own used car salesman in the group, Rick, down in Ashland. And in his early days, Rick had learned some of these tricks as well about the car business. And he felt at that time that that's what you needed to do to succeed. And it wasn't always being truthful, and it wasn't always doing the right thing. When he met me and when he started to put his feet upon the path, he decided that he was going to change the way that he did business and that he would treat people honestly. He would keep a God-centered consciousness about his business. And it wasn't always easy. There are times when the old patterns would present themselves to him. And if he just said something or avoided telling somebody a truth about something, it could have gone down a lot easier. But he knew, and he was absolutely dedicated to doing business in this new way. And he stuck with it. And it began to pay off dividends. And then eventually he moved towards selling vans for people who have disabilities. And so they are wheelchair access vans. They have lifts and all the sort. And he's gotten into specializing into this area. He has people come from many states to his place because of the way that he does business. They will travel from Washington State, they'll travel from California, they'll travel from Oregon and further away in order to come to his place of business. And not only does he make a good living from it, but people have such gratitude, and he forms positive, loving relationships with the people he's doing business with. And there's nothing that he looks back on that he looks at with regret now. Because he's doing business in this way. I once worked for a man at an antique store. I became the manager of the store eventually and worked my way up through it. And he and I would go on buying trips. And this man lied constantly. Sometimes it was just a slight exaggeration, and he was humorous, so sometimes it was done in humor. But other times it went and stretched credulity way beyond any recognizable kind of form. And there were even times I was not around where he would steal. And he would take things when he had not bought them from an individual. And so as I came to know this, I would talk to him from time to time. And one time we were out on a buying trip. And I was driving the semi-truck that we went out to South Dakota with, and we were buying these antique furnitures. And I had just listened to one too many lies. And finally, on the way back, I said, you know what? I don't think I can be in business with you anymore. I never told lies myself, but I would listen to him, so I was a party to it, you might say. And I said, I just don't think I can do this. And it turned into a very loud argument between the two of us as we were driving down. And finally, we were in Idaho, and he says, well, let me out of this truck. I'm going to fly home. He didn't like the way the conversation went. And neither did I. And when I got back, that was the last time that I worked for him. And it was is difficult to do in a way, because it was standing up for what was true, but he said, you don't understand. A person cannot be in business and be honest and be successful. That was his premise. And I said, I don't believe that that's true. My own father had been a businessman, and I would say to every degree that I know, he was always extremely honest, extremely upfront, never told a lie, never exaggerated, and he was very successful. And besides Rick, I've known many other people who have been very successful in business and been very honest and forthright. Sometimes business people, especially large businesses, they get a bad reputation. But we look at, for instance, the founders of Microsoft and Paul Allen and the other Bill Gates, and they've done wonderful things with the monies that they've amassed. They have huge institutions that all they do is they give away money, but they try to do it intelligently because they are businessmen. They realize that money can easily be wasted. And so they work very hard to make sure that that money makes a difference. It's not just money that's spent for the sake of spending money. And this is a wonderful thing. It's a wonderful thing. And there are many, many people like that. America, by and large, is a very generous country. And as a country, they give more money than any other country in the world. And by far more money. By individual contributions to charities and other kinds of relief organizations. We are all in business. We all run a business, whether you work for somebody else or not. You run the business of your own life. You run the business in the way that you see fit. You're the CEO of your organization, and your organization is yourself. And you need to ask yourself, how well do I run the organization? Do I set my priorities correctly? Do I spend my money wisely? Am I honest in my dealings with myself and with others? Do I tell the truth? Do I serve God in the business of my life? And as I say, whether we're an employee at an organization or whether we are self-employed, the questions are the same. Because you are ultimately responsible for the things that you do and what you participate in. And just like myself with this man who did not do business in the right way, I eventually had to sever myself. It was too much. He crossed the line too often for me. And we have to make those decisions. They're not always easy, and they're not always black and white. Because there are many times good things that go along with the things we have to swallow. But at some point, we may come to that decision where we decide we just can't continue in this way. So as Christian yogis, as those who are following a spiritual path and seeking to serve in this world, it's important that we guide the business of our life in very exacting kinds of ways. That we hold ourselves to a high accountability and high standards. And if we do this, when we leave this body, we will leave it with a clear conscience. You know, when you leave this body, there is only a few questions that will be really important to you. And you know what? The things that you own, the claim that the world has given you, these will mean very, very little to you at that time. What you will take with you and what will stay with you is what you've done, the patterns that you have set, how you have guided and directed your life, the kind of ways that you've served, the things that you have given. That is what will resonate inside of you. And if you come up with an empty bank account on these different topics, then you'll feel very impoverished indeed. And that's no matter how much money, how much wealth, how many things that you've had in your life. It won't make one God-blessed bit of difference. And so we guide our lives in this way. The idea of dying and reminded me of a joke that I heard the other day that I thought was quite funny that could go into our article Out of the Mouths of Babes, because this preschool child was preschool and her mother took time off from her work. She worked in a funeral home, and so she showed up at her daughter's school, and one of the other children asked her, "So what do you do for a living?" And the daughter piped up before the mother could answer, and she says, "My mother sells underground furniture." I thought that was wonderful. So, stanza 12 from Master. The God-united yogi, abandoning attachment to fruits of action, attains the peace unshakable because rooted in self-discipline. The man who is not united to God is ruled by desires. Through such attachments, he remains in bondage. And the spiritual interpretation. The yogi who works without desire for the fruits of his actions, through lack of needless distraction, becomes united to God and finds divine peace. Now, what does attachment mean exactly? We all know attachment when we feel it. And I've used the example in the past because it's a simple one. If you've ever gone bowling, most of us have at one time or another in our life, and if we have a little bit of beginner's luck, we roll that ball down and we knock over some pins. And we go, "Oh, well, this is something that I can do." And then we try to get in control of the process. We become attached to knocking down all the pins. And the next thing we know, we're putting gutter balls in. And we can no longer guide the ball properly because we're trying too hard. We're not allowing the flow to happen through us. And whenever you become attached to something, you become so overly consumed with what the outcome is going to be that it begins to interfere with your doing it in the first place. And it causes stress inside of you. It agitates the mind. You're not focused exactly on what you're doing, and so you begin to drop things, you bump into things, you're not mindful of what you're doing, and we make many more mistakes. And we pay a huge price in terms of burned up life energy. We're just burning life energy for no reason at all because we're anxious. And anxiety burns life energy. When we are calm and focused on the task at hand, we obviously have a goal in mind. If we're cleaning the kitchen floor and we're sweeping it and then we're mopping it, we actually want a clean floor when we're done, obviously. That's our goal. When we're very attached to it, we don't feel like we're getting it done fast enough, things aren't going well enough, or is it going to be nice enough when we get it done? We're filled with anxiety and anticipation all the way through. The opposite is to be very calm and to be very attuned to what we're doing. So as we're sweeping, we're only sweeping. As we're mopping, we're only mopping. We're completely centered in the activity itself. Now, somebody may say, "Well, what a boring prospect just to do that," but it's not that way. Somehow, as we become completely centered and focused and mindful of what we're doing in the moment, there's a great deal of peace and a great deal of sense of serenity that comes about as a result. And when you apply the same principle to whatever it is you're doing, but you may say, "Well, I'm very busy. I have lots of demands. I have this and that, and I've got 20 other things to do that are all lined up while I'm doing this thing." And you see what the cost is to you as you do that day after day. It depletes you of life energy. And eventually, you don't have any enthusiasm or pleasure for what you're doing. because you've burned yourself out. Practice bringing in the mind, not extending it out over those 10 or 20 things yet to be done. When you choose a thing to do, focus on that thing only, and then focus on the doing of that thing, not on the outcome, not on the result. The result will come naturally enough on its own, and give the results over to God, who's in ultimate control and authority over those results. Stay focused on exactly what you're doing. You'll make fewer mistakes. You will not burn away life energy. You will not be worn out at the end of the day. And you will feel that intimate connection and flow of God consciousness moving through you as you do what you do. Your fulfillment will come from the activity itself and not just from the outcome. The outcome will happen, sure enough. But when the outcome comes, you will feel a complete sense of joy as you have through every step of the process. Now, I cannot emphasize how important this is. How we waste life energy, how we waste ourselves in other ways. And as Peter pointed out in his article, if you are with God, you cannot be scared. You cannot be operating in fear because they are opposites of one another. When you feel the peace of God, when you feel the presence of God, when you feel the flow of God, you will not be in a state of fear. You will not be in a state of anxiety. And you will be completely and totally focused on the task at hand. And you will feel the presence of God. This is karma yogi. Being a karma yogi. And it is karma yoga. Yoga means union with the God through karma, through action, through activity, through the work that you do. You are united with God. You are not separated from God. And this is a beautiful and wonderful. We all have to have activity. As Krishna said, as long as you breathe, as long as you eat, you are in activity. You are in an action. So you cannot pretend that you are not. So this is a wonderful, wonderful teaching here. Those who lead unbalanced lives perform actions for egotistical interest. They confusedly roam in a labyrinth of endless longings. By performing actions to satisfy the unquenchable desires of the ego, they forfeit all peace. The emancipated yogi, one with the blessed God, works for him only. He knows the earth to be a dream drama of divine activities. And so this is how we should be in this world. And it's a wonderful time. A new year is a new beginning. And it's a wonderful time to really focus ourselves, to learn to surrender even while we're in the midst of activities, and to realize that when we are in business with God, we're in business with all of life. That there can be no separation. I will close here with a quote from Papa. Ram Dass does not want anyone to lead only a contemplative life. One must also serve one's fellow beings in a selfless spirit. Love thy neighbor as thyself does not mean that love should be only felt in the heart. It must be shown also in action, in the form of relieving distress and rendering help in all possible ways. To serve man is to serve God. In karma yoga, work is done as worship. Then alone it gives joy. It should be done as perfectly as possible, with great care and love, and never in a slipshod, clumsy, irregular, or half-hearted way. The inner beauty must reveal itself in outer conduct. So let us dedicate ourselves to this proposition. Let us explore it within our own lives. If we don't find that everything is in the flow of God immediately, do not be discouraged. Take it as a challenge and use God as your partner. Say, God, show me how. Lead me through this. Guide me in all my ways. Show me how everything that I do can be united with you through an inner communion, and that I may feel you and know you and be one with you, and that universal vision will be mine now and always. When you do this, you will be in business with God, and it will permeate every part of your life. Please pray with me, O Heavenly Father.
Divine Mother.
I feel the wonder and the beauty of Thy glorious presence.
In every part of my being.
My heart is bursting with my love for thee. I kneel in adoration at thy feet. And surrender myself to thee.
I feel the power of thy perfection.
Surging in every cell of my body. My mind and my intelligence. Are radiant with thy healing light. My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss. Of my communion with thee. I and my Father are one. Blessed Spirit, I am He.
Peace. Bliss.
Amen. Pronouns, I bow to the light within you.